And let me just get a level now. So just count to five.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
That's perfect. Okay, I'm going to do a countdown. 3, 2. Aloha. This is the Travel Angel Show, and I am so happy to have Patricia Schultz. Patricia Schultz is the author of a book that I absolutely love called 1,000 Places to See Before You Die. And also, I found out by going to your website, Patricia, you actually have quite a few other beautiful things included now, including a journal that you can do.
Yes, and we have a board game. We have calendars. The 1,000 Places concept continues.
Well, and it's beautiful because I really love this book. Of course, since I love to travel, and I think who doesn't, right? This is the kind of book you look at and you get ideas for. And there was a publication put out in 2003, but you completely did this all over and have really got some new 200, at least 200 new places. So how did you combine the 1,000 places with 200 more?
I know the math is potentially confusing to some people, but the first book, as you mentioned, that came out in 2003 was researched through much of the 90s because it took me 8 years to put the book together. So much has changed. The revision that came out last year took an additional 5 years, and I took the first book and kind of deconstructed it and wound up merging many of the places, sometimes 2, 3, even 4 of the destinations into one, creating kind of trails or even mini itineraries, and thus opening the book to hundreds of new places all around the world. And so what I have now is a book that I feel is far more representative of how people travel, how they want to travel, how I've been traveling these last many years, and all these new places I've discovered along the way since.
Well, you know, when I first began traveling, the places, and that was many years ago, the places I wanted to see were places I kind of always felt that maybe I would have naturally been born in another lifetime. And, you know, places that kind of resonated, that always had a mystery, you know, like Egypt for me and places like that. And what's interesting is with your book, you actually can look at a place and go, wow, that place resonates with me, but I wouldn't have even maybe thought of it if I hadn't read the book.
Yeah, well, that's the very purpose from the beginning with the original edition, as well as, of course, the revision, is that it was meant to open people's minds and heads and eyes, to remind them of all of these incredible places that are no great surprises, you know, all of the Egypts and the Taj Mahals and the Grand Canyons and the great museums of the world, the iconic, right. But then to throw in all of these little known or totally unknown places into the mix. So you have, I think, what is a great compilation. So there's something of everything at the end of the day for everyone, because people have very different ideas of what must be seen in their life. And as my father used to say, I wouldn't walk across the street to see that. So places that may just leave you cold are the very places that other people, you know, would kind of trade their firstborn children to see. So the book is this great mix, I hope, and a very intoxicating mix that will get people off the couch.
Well, it's kind of interesting for me. I don't know if everyone does it, but there's some places that are a little more adventuresome that I do. In fact, one of the ones I'm thinking of was when I went to China in 1988. And at that time, you had to have a bus guide that was a Chinese, mm-hmm. that was actually a government official, mm-hmm. that would be with you at all times. And you only go to the appropriate places that they deem you should see. But the country fascinated me so much that I decided to see, well, what does it take to do my own tour? And strangely enough, I was able to, I guess with 10 people at that time, create a tour with some friends I had from the Sonoma Mountain Zen Center who were Chinese American. And so we did a Zen tour. And my gosh, what a different experience when I was not doing what I was told to be doing, but creating a place. And I imagine there's lots of places you've gone where you kind of just do an introductory, like just eating the appetizers, and then you go back for the full course meal another time.
Yeah, and I always encourage people who are either not very traveled or hesitant or nervous travelers or people traveling alone who are very close to not quite leaving home, so many, you know, hesitations do they have, to sign up with these tours, because it may not be the ideal way, but it just gives you some insight, and it gives you, like you said, a kind of appetizer taste of the destination, and you get a lay of the land, and you see a little bit that will have you know that at some point in your life you have to return and see it far more in depth and far more personally or far more surreptitiously and kind of wander and get lost rather than follow a regimented tour. But I've taken countless trips like that, and I would never consider them a waste or a regret. If anything, they've gotten me entree to a destination that perhaps I otherwise was too intimidated by to tour alone or to tour more elaborately. So many of those tours are economical. They're suggestible for or recommended for people who are traveling alone or whose, you know, traveling companion is as hesitant as you. So I recommend them very much so. Not everybody is as kind of intrepid and adventurous and, you know, the great explorer that we all like to think we have inside of us. But the more you travel, the more it enables you, and it empowers you to realize that you can do this, that, you know, there are lovely people and patient and helpful people all over the world, that if you get lost, it's not the end of the world. And if there's a language problem, nothing that a smile or a gesture mm-hmm. can't overcome and resolve. So the more you travel, I think just the more you become relaxed about it, always excited, but more relaxed in knowing that you will see home again.
Well, you know, that's so true. It's interesting because I hate the idea of doing cruises, but cruises came down so low in price last year that I was able to get a 12-night cruise in the Mediterranean, mm-hmm. which wasn't that big a deal because I'd been to all the major countries, but then they did include Montenegro and Croatia, and
oh, cool.
I had never been to Montenegro and Croatia. Mm-hmm. And of course, having that new experience of a couple of countries I didn't know anything about. I didn't know where Split was or anything. You know, I mean, that, what a strange name for a town, Split. But, I mean, it was fascinating to be able to explore there. And I think that that's all kind of becoming in Europe a pretty major destination. But a lot of people in the United States still haven't made it up the Dalmatian coast or anything.
Yeah, you know, I didn't, in fact, include all of these countries that made up the former Yugoslavia in my first book because, again, in the 90s, they were going through a whole series of civil wars and were very, very much off the radar for tourism, not just American tourists who barely knew where it was, even as Yugoslavia, but even for European tourists. But now, you know, they're flourishing, they're open for business, they've got more tourism, again, European tourists, and they know what to do with. But Americans go there in very small numbers. So these former Yugoslavian countries, now Slovenia, Croatia, Montenegro, Bosnia, etc., are all in my revision. They are some of the 28 new countries and make up, you know, the hundreds of new places that I referred to before that are now on my radar and back, you know, in business, as I said. It's hard to believe in some of those destinations, such as Slovenia, which is north of Croatia, that there ever was a war. But in the southern countries now, they're all independent countries. There still are a lot of the leftover ravages of war and mm-hmm. the bullet holes in the walls, those beautiful mm-hmm. walls that surround Dubrovnik. Dubrovnik saw a lot of damage during the war. It's the southernmost city on that beautiful Dalmatian coast that you mentioned in Croatia, 1,000 islands off the Dalmatian mm-hmm. coast of Croatia, just spectacular. So that area of the eastern Mediterranean is an emerging destination for Americans. The Europeans have been going there since forever, but for us it's something new and exciting. And they call it, you know, the Mediterranean of 20, 30 years ago because it's not quite as developed as the Italian Riviera or the French Riviera, but it's by no means, you know, a backwater because, as I mentioned before, it gets so many people from Italy and France, Germany, from Scandinavia.
How many countries have you gone to?
You know, I don't know. And someday,
you're gonna have
in our
sit
next
down.
Snowstorm here in New York, I'm going to have to sit down and count. I don't know. I don't, you know, give much heed to, you know, me, the queen of lists. I don't give much heed to this idea of counting the countries that you've been to. I understand the fun in it, and it gives you an idea of, you know, just how many you have under your belt. But I'm far more interested in all of the places that I haven't yet seen and mm-hmm. when I'll get to go there and how to make them happen. So I'm always forward-looking.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many countries, and I don't know how many places in the book, although my gut reaction is that I've been to about 80% of them.
So when you go to a place and you've traveled all around the world, what tip could you give people to really give yourself an open state of mind and actually getting yourself in the right setting, right mindset for where you're going to really make the most out of your journey there?
Well, the advice I would give myself is the very thing that I do, and that is research.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a friend who travels alone, and he's far more of a kind of footloose and carefree traveler. And because he's so busy, he doesn't not do the research because he's not interested. He quite simply does not have the time.
Mm-hmm.
So he'll grab a guidebook or download a guidebook or two these days. That's the way you go electronically. And, you know, read on the plane on the way there and kind of always seems to land on his feet, coming back with incredible stories to tell. But I like to know what awaits. Even though once you arrive, it's often something quite different from any of your expectations. But at least you have, you know, a running idea of what you want to see, the great things not to miss, you know, all of its attractions, all of its attributes, a little bit of the history, the heritage, the people, what kind of food you can, you know, you need to ask for, the specialties not to overlook. So I like to know that I'm going with at least half a brain, rather than going kind of blindly and, you know, handing myself over to the gods of serendipity. But I guess maybe a mix of both, or really it depends on how you like to travel and do you like to just, you know, wander and get lost and stumble upon great things and have everything a surprise and, you know, surpass your expectations. Or do you want to go well-informed, as I like to do, because that's just my character?
Mm-hmm. When you travel and you're going to lots of places, how do you pack? Now, this is really, for women, I think it's much more difficult than men. But, I mean, I'm the kind of person who likes choices. And if you're going to a few countries, you might be actually going to a few different temperature possibilities. And so do you have certain rules for packing for these trips that you like?
Yes, but you have to remember that I'm sitting here in New York City and I'm speaking to someone from the island.
Yes.
So when I tell you that I bring a lot of black.
Mm-hmm. That's so true.
It's kind of our uniform
here. It is,
here.
But in Europe too, it's amazing every time.
Yeah.
I have a little story about that. I love going to Paris. I've probably been there about 20 times. But
wow.
There's always these fashions, you know, oh my gosh, talk about fashions. Fashions. And so I've noticed that different times they have different colors that are the popular color of the season.
Mm-hmm.
So I always indulge in at least one nice outfit. So I went and got this. One year it was orange, and I'm a redhead. So I got this really nice orange suit and wanted to go out and use it. So I went out to dinner, and I walk into this nice restaurant, and I'm wearing orange, and everyone is in black, and everyone just looks at me like, what is that?
Who's the Halloween lady?
I guess that's just for the windows, but they're not going to get out of their black.
So, well, you made your statement.
And I still have that orange suit, but I very rarely wear it.
But, you know, there is a lot to be said for black, and only once was I in a developing nation of some sort where they actually asked me if I had lost a loved one. And I just went with it and said yes, because at some point in my life I had lost a loved one. It wasn't necessarily recent. But, I can dress it up, I dress it down, I bring a lot of accessories, I bring a lot of scarves, and the scarves often have color because you don't want to look too menacing or too unapproachable or just too unimaginative. And costume jewelry, essentially, I never bring anything that I would dye if I lost it. You don't want to bring anything precious. And I always bring two pairs of shoes because as comfortable as they are, it's always a joy to change them. And if one gets wet in the monsoon or it gets muddy because you've gone on an unexpected trek, so they need to both be comfortable. They need to, you know, forget the stiletto heels and the fashion statement that you were so intent upon making. And I just try to be practical while looking presentable. The comic the novelist, the author, David Sedaris, once wrote this unforgettable statement about how Americans travel abroad looking like they're going to mow somebody's lawn.
What a great description.
I know. I remember riding the subway in London, and, you know, there's one thing for all the 20-year-olds to be, you know, dressed in some bizarre kind of gothic would-be fashion thing. But it's another thing to just be messy and sloppy and look like, you know, you haven't showered in a year. So, and the way, you know, Americans travel on airplanes, I know that we've come a long way since dressing up as our parents used to do and wearing skirts and dresses and uncomfortable things. But really, you know, everybody looks like they're on their way to the gym. So
yeah.
I do try to, you know, represent my country and feel that if I'm going to let everybody know that I'm from America, that at least they won't think that we're all on some kind of, you know, wardrobe budget.
Well, you know, I so agree with you on this. And maybe I'm old-fashioned, but, you know, I really do think that people only have a few moments and they look at you and they kind of have to understand where you're at by sometimes what you're wearing. And if you do look like you just came out of a thrift shop, I mean, that is going to be the first impression. And also the same thing, you know, what you're wearing on the plane is what you're going to be getting into when you walk into that hotel.
Yeah,
and you know, you've seen how they look at you in Europe and some of these hotels when you walk in. It's like, oh my gosh, I don't even know.
I know you want to say, please, I've just been on an airplane for 30 hours. Do not judge me.
I mean, the doorman didn't want to open the door for me the last time I was staying at a nice hotel. And I went, I don't think I'm good enough to have the door open for me even. But it is interesting. You know, when you have gone to some places, have you felt, gosh, I really, of all the tons of places you've gone to, has there been ones going, I really, really want to retire here. I want to really live here. I know you like New York and you're comfortable there, but have you had a couple of places call you?
I think that more so I would like to go back with more time and just return with the luxury of a month, maybe. But I so am not interested in complicating life with a second home that is outside of America, because the more, you know, I've traveled, the more that I understand that this really is home for me. And there's a great quote that I just put on my Facebook the other day, which is that the best way to yourself is around the world. So I understood early on that, you know, I lived 5 years in Italy, I lived in France, and it was always with the intention of some point in the not too terribly distant future to return home, because I always loved America. You know, I'm patriotic in the average sense. I appreciate what we have, and I especially appreciate what America represents by traveling more and more as, you know, the years go by, or the decades go by. But as, you know, the question is a great one, and I know that people return to Italy and buy that farmhouse or that villa and then, you know, feel obligated to use it at least once a month for, once a year for a month, maybe every summer, for the rest of their lives because of the investment and because they've kind of tied themselves into a property or an investment on the other side of the globe. And I'd rather not have that. You know, I'd rather kind of downsize.
That philosophy right there is exactly why timeshares in Hawaii do so well. People come here and then they're told they could have a timeshare and they buy it. And I don't know how many times then they try to get rid of it, or they realize they aren't going to really come once a year. And so then that timeshare is really virtually worthless, you know, to
yeah,
them.
Yeah, because, you know, my friend has been back to Guadalajara, I think, like 125 times. You know, she found some place she loved, and it's just exotic enough for her to feel that, you know, she's doing something exciting and, you know, outside of her comfort zone. But it's Guadalajara.
Yeah.
And, you know, after two or three visits, I'm thinking maybe you should see the other trillion places in the world that are. So I don't like to be tied to anything like that. But there are so many incredibly beautiful and inviting and alluring places everywhere that I always think, oh, to come back for even, you know, 10 days or 2 weeks, because I always seem to be kind of hitting the ground running and breathlessly rushing through these mm-hmm. destinations. So I don't know if that will ever happen, that I don't all that often return to places. As I said before, I'm just so aware of how many places there are still, you know, yet to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
But in a perfect life, perhaps when I manage to clone myself and have all kinds of free time and open budgets, I would like to go back to it. I can't imagine how many places. I know the list is long.
The virtual Patricia Schultz travels in a virtual self, in a holographic world. I read somewhere that you actually worked doing some travel guidebooks in the beginning with Pauline Frommer.
Yeah, isn't that funny?
Arthur
was my professor. It was my university. I didn't have a lot of direct contact with Arthur Frommer, but writing for Frommer's guides for about 10 years was one of the I wrote for a number of guides, actually, because you know, no offense to Frommer's, but they paid truly very little. But that's pretty much how guidebook writing mm-hmm. then and now was and is and forever will be.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an incredible grounding and education for me, and it was a very rewarding period because I came to know the destinations that I wrote about inside out, as I was professionally obligated to do, and spent all kinds of time researching in ways that as a casual traveler I just would not have. So, and I also came to know a lot about travel writing and researching and, you know, what you needed to know and how you needed to hopefully evocatively commit it to print. So it was a very, very rewarding 10-year period for me. I also wrote for a number of other guidebooks. And then, as I said, they don't pay much, so I would always parlay it into other magazine articles and other assignments and this and that and newspapers. And somehow I made a living out of it, but it wasn't easy because it's just not a very lucrative profession. But I lived like a millionaire.
Mm.
You know, I traveled so much in a way that would just not have been possible with a 9-to-5 job and just two precious weeks of vacation a year. That is so not what I wanted.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And then from that, is that what kind of gave you the base and the foundation to do a 1,000 places to see before you die?
Yeah, because I had been writing professionally for many years, and I was the go-to person. People would ask me, you know, so what's your favorite getaway for the springtime? Or my sister's daughter's going on her honeymoon, where should she go? Or my parents are celebrating their 50th wedding anniversary, we want to send them someplace special. And I realized I had this wealth of information in my head. It made my head hurt.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I need to create some kind of great book that has all of this between two covers. And I happened upon a publisher that was on the same page as me, if I may use that expression.
That's a good line, yes.
And he was a great visionary as well. So he took this whole idea of 1,000 places and really, you know, ran with it from the very beginning and continues to do so. So between the two of us, we very much kept this idea afloat, doing all of those other products that you were talking about, calendars and board games and a map with pins for the walls so you can see at a glance, you know, the certain colored pins are where you've been, other colored pins are where you want to go. So it all comes back to this idea of how big the world is and how incredible the opportunities and the choices, and where do you even begin? And you have one very, 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 very precious life, and how do you want to how do you want to live it?
Mm-hmm. And the website that people can go to see all of the great products and to order your products?
It's on 1000places.com. And also trips that I host. This year I'll be hosting a number of trips to Ethiopia and Mongolia, to Antarctica. I know, Cindy, I think you should come.
Wow. Well, the Antarctica, you know, that's all of a sudden we're seeing more and more shows about that. And yeah. I had a friend who just actually did a cruise and went down one area, and she said, Cindy, you're going to Alaska, because I haven't done the Inside Passage. She says, you should forget the Inside Passage. You should go down there. It's amazing when you see the waterfalls and the glaciers, and it's supposed to be awesome.
Yeah, I know. It's hard for me to believe as a mainlander that Alaska even belongs to us. Mm-hmm. The natural beauty is just stunning, 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 really beautiful. Antarctica does not belong to us, and it seems like it's on the other, you know, kind of down at the bottom of the world, the undiscovered or the uncharted waters of that area. And I never thought that those kind of polar areas of, you know, ice and glaciers, et cetera, would really appeal to me. But, you know, as I travel, I change in my what does call to me, mm-hmm. or destinations that perhaps, you know, 20, 30 years ago I would not have made a priority. So we do change, I think,
the entire community of travelers are changing, and the baby boomers as well have gone to a lot of the beginner places and are looking for more adventuresome and exotic mm-hmm. places. And Ethiopia, and when are you doing the trip to Antarctica?
Is in November, and it also includes, because I've always wanted to go and never have, the Falkland Islands.
Mm.
You begin at Ushuaia, which is the southernmost city in the world, and it's at the very tip of Patagonia in Argentina, and you get on the ship. It's run by Quark Expeditions, and we go to Falklands, and then we go to South Georgia, which is famous for its rookeries of hundreds of thousands of penguins,
mm-hmm.
and then we sail down to the Antarctic Peninsula. So it's all pretty intoxicating, isn't it?
You know, it really is. And so people can sign up for your particular travels. And
I'm hosting a trip. The ship holds about 180, 190 people.
Oh, that's perfect.
And it's with Quark Expeditions. It is in November. And then in July to Mongolia, I'm going for what is called the Mongolian Olympics. And there are the special games, which are old traditional games.
This is supposed to be amazing.
Yeah, I know. I'm very excited. So that's in July. And then Ethiopia is rather soon-ish. It's the end of April. And that, to me, Ethiopia, to me, was, I think, kind of Africa's best-kept secret. I was once just 5 years ago, and I'm still reeling. It was such a very, very special and magical place with some of the nicest people anywhere, not just in Africa, but anywhere. I'm very lucky to be asked to host these trips, and they're always destinations that are very special to me.
Well, I think it's so wonderful, and I really would look forward to actually taking one of those special trips with you. And again, 1,000 places, is it 1,000 places?
Yes, it's 1000places.com.
Well, Patricia, you have done so much to help people and expand their mind and awareness of places to go and see. And I just love what you're doing, and it's really wonderful. So I'm so glad you took the time to give us a call.
Thank you, Cindy.
And if you ever make it back out to Maui, again, I'd love to have you here. I would just love to have you in studio. I'll show you around Maui. And
we
could talk story.
Be careful what you ask for.
No, I mean it. I do mean
I'll be
it.
Knocking on your studio door.
I would love it. I would
Otherwise, we'll just have to meet in the Falkland Islands. How does that sound?
Sounds cold.
Yes. The Galapagos of the Atlantic.
Well, thank you so much for your time, and I'll be in touch, and I'm going to get you one of my books, so I'll find out the best way to get it to you. So
wonderful. Okay. Thank you very, very, very much.
Thank you very much for you and your wonderful work that you've done, and a big aloha.
Thank you. To you too, Cindy. Bye-bye.
Bye.